Welcome to Simulcast. I'm Victoria Brazel.
I'm Ben Simon.
I'm Jesse Spur.
I'm Jess Stokes Parrish, and you're listening to Simulcast.
Connecting the healthcare simulation community.
So welcome to Simulcast. I'm Victoria Brazel, and I'm joined again by Ben Simon to do our March Journal Club episode. How are you, Ben?
I'm good, my friend. Looking forward to another good month.
Me too. And I am just home from a lovely day down at in Melbourne with the Gandel Simulation Service, and in fact the burgeoning State of Victoria, Victorian Translational Simulation Collective Group. So it was an exciting day of people presenting really excellent work. So enjoyed being there, and another excellent talk from Walter Epic talking about teamwork. So yeah, that's what's been happening in my sim world.
That sounds pretty exciting, and a lovely collection of people. And I saw some lovely comments about it on social media as well.
All right. Well, we've got four articles this week, as usual. And Ben, I think you're going to kick us off with something we've been looking for forever, which is an article that demystifies simulators.
100%. So I think this is absolutely an overwhelming field for many people, particularly early on. And so I was excited to see one of my favorite types of publications, i.e. an essay from people who I think are smart. So this is entitled Demystifying Simulators for Educators in Healthcare by Brendan Goodwin and Deborah Nestel. And as you mentioned, this is an essay that attempts to demystify the growing number of technologies and simulators available, and describes how an understanding of the pros and cons of those technologies can inform simulationists' decision-making when selecting the appropriate simulation modality for any given objective. I think they start by pretty accurately highlighting how overwhelming the amount of choices that we actually have now is, and they point out that simulation itself is no longer a monolithic concept. It can be so broadly adaptable to so many things that can be freeing and exciting, but it can also actually be pretty overwhelming, because particularly if you don't have a schematic to consider and sort those choices. Importantly for me, I think rather than add to the confusion by creating another taxonomy, which we're often tempted to do in publication, the authors highlight a pre-existing one from 2013 by, I hope I pronounced this right and probably won't, Chiniara et al. In Simulation and Healthcare, where four overlapping categories are presented in a Venn diagram. So that's computer-based, procedural, simulated clinical immersion, and simulated patient. They describe computer-based simulation as one which allows learners to interact with a simulated system or virtual patients, and is usually via screen-based interfaces. Procedural sim, which is sim which predominantly serves the psychomotor domain of learning objectives and is used by participants to learn and improve upon technical and procedural skills like part-task trainers. Simulated clinical immersion, which is an interesting one for me, where participants explore clinical challenges in a setting with high environmental realism, like a busy emergency department, and simulated participants, which they describe as encounters that replicate real encounters with real patients utilizing human actors. And look, this is a pretty big essay that covers a lot of foundational and important topics that I couldn't sort of cover all here. And I think it's well worth a read. If you're looking for a quick and dirty speed date through that, I actually suggest reading the tables, table 1 and 2, which are excellent. So table 1 is a lovely breakdown of a pretty big array of different sim modalities, as well as their benefits and limitations. And table 2 I really liked. It flips the script and categorizes learning outcome domains, and then makes recommendations on what options would likely be the best choices. So for example, if you're considering rote knowledge, then you might want to choose computer-based simulation. More importantly, though, I think there's some lovely calls to discipline, I guess you'd say, or design discipline within the essay. There's some nice discussion on realism, what that means and how that can influence simulations, and making a choice to select a level of realism that is synergistic with the goals of the simulation rather than a perceived hierarchy of what is best. And an emphasis on overall just making deliberate design choices in our scenarios that are informed by our learning objectives and core principles. So I enjoyed it a lot. How about yourself, Vic?
Oh, definitely enjoyed it a lot. A few things I really liked about it. One was how they bravely jumped into the discussion around realism and fidelity. And there was a quote I liked about stopping to reference against the real world and instead referencing against, and I quote, the minimal characteristics of real world features that are needed for a given educational experience, unquote. And I guess that is the essence of functional task alignment or other words that we've heard describing those things. And I think that's so important rather than just trying to replicate everything. Instead, you think about what are really important. I also like table one. I thought that was a really nice overview of something that's super hard to try and create. And I think the one thing that's tricky with this is it's a text-based article. And what I would have loved is some little pictures and videos. And I feel like then if you, I couldn't help, obviously, as you would have, read this through the eyes of someone who knew what they were talking about. So it made sense to me. But I still wonder, if you were a novice, can this mean something to you without the images and an idea about it? So IJOS, being the forward-thinking journal it is, I suspect they'll probably get more multimedia-type offerings, and this would have lent itself to it.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. I did wonder, with the level of sort of rich expertise within the article, whether this was as entry level as intended. That's a very tricky needle to thread when you've got someone with lots of knowledge. And I think they threaded it pretty well. But I can imagine someone who's just standing out in SIM might need something before that to sort of step up. But no, a lovely article and synthesis of a lot of complex concepts.
Yeah, and I think for people who are just starting, it's a good read. For anyone else, it's also a good read. But I think also if people are putting together little faculty development packages, I could imagine this going nicely in one of the introductory sections. All right, I think I'm going to move on to our next article. And this is titled Trauma Surgical Simulation, Discussing the Replacement of Live Animals Used as Human Patient Simulators. And this is from Kara Swain et al. Just recently in Advances. And the background to this, as you know, Ben, when doctors first started doing simulation of their medical procedures, they largely practiced on cadavers and live, sometimes anaesthetized animals, although the history of this is a little bit murky. And we know that for a host of very good practical and ethical reasons, we've shifted away from this. And this has been helped by a lot of good advances that we've had in technology, you know, plastics, hydrogels, bioprinting, etc. But as they point out in this article, there's still gaps in adequate realism of a lot of things for some procedures. And we'll talk about what those are shortly. So the article basically says, well, how do we continue to move away from using animals in particular in medical training while still creating optimal educational experiences? And as I was reading that, Ben, I had a flashback to a book I read when I was in medical school called Brother Surgeons, about John and William Hunter. I don't know if you ever came across that. But this was in the 1700s, and they were brothers who were surgeons, and it was particularly around anatomy and dissection. And they basically did kind of steal bodies from graves.
Oh, I was just going to say the same thing, because I was with Dan Houghton in the, I forget the fancy name, but the College of Surgeons exhibit in Edinburgh, and they talked a fair amount about acknowledging the amount of grave robbing that was happening. Mm.
Yes, so there is a bit of dark and murky history. Anyway, back to the article. As I said, Kara Swain and her colleagues give us a really overview of where we're at in this. So they start by going back to a foundational position statement from 1959, which was actually about using animals in research. But it gave a nice little acronym, the three R's, about how we should be aiming to replace, reduce, and refine animal use in research, but also obviously relevant to medical training. And then they go through a host of literature reviews of studies that compare what they call live tissue training with other modalities. And they conclude that the key gaps are in, and I'm going to quote here, tissue tactility, physiologic responsiveness, and psychological engagement during the simulation. So the way I interpret that is blood feels kind of warm and sticky, which is quite hard to simulate. Uncontrolled bleeding as you watch it actually feels very stressful. And the tissue feel is obviously quite nuanced, and different soft tissues like bowel does feel different to liver, does feel different to kidney and obviously bone. So the body of the article then describes the deliberations of a workshop from the CSAM conference last year. And just then they describe what happened. They gave an initial presentation, and then the working group were asked to reflect on three reasons why live animals are used within surgical trauma simulation. And I think this narrow focus is probably important here. And then consider potential solutions to replace or refine animal use. And then they tried to get a consensus of opinion. And it was a pretty mixed group of participants. There was some surgeons and clinicians, some researchers, and they presented a summary statement, which was sort of underwhelming in a way. No single model can presently meet the rationale for using a live animal model. So, they did give some suggestions for replacement using perfused cadaveric tissue. So that would be actually taking a cadaver and then somehow managing to run blood through it. Perfused ex vivo organs, so taking out a kidney or a liver and perfusing it again with blood, because bleeding obviously is a really big part of if you're training for trauma surgery. But obviously then getting onto more synthetic things like hydrogel, silicon, gelatin, and 3D bioprinting. So my thoughts, Ben, look, their conclusion was hardly surprising. Once again, the same issues about functional task alignment and what's important for you to practice trauma surgery and touch and physiologic response of yourselves to bleeding actually are important for the learning objectives they're trying to do. But at the same time, a bit like the last article showed us, really almost nothing is a one-stop shop for training. So I don't know why we would think that a single modality was ever going to do it. But I do think probably the answer to this is going to end up being VR, because I think VR will get to the point where we've got the visual, we've got the tactile, and we've got the auditory, and we can get that level of realism that's going to be there. I do not think it is there yet, but my hope would be that those sorts of things are what VR is going to be probably fairly good at.
I hope so. I'm a bit more of a cynic so far based on my PlayStation research, but
anxiety. Oh, I am a cynic for it right now too, and I don't know the place of it yet, but once we can do that, and I suspect we will get there.
Yeah, 100%. It makes sense.
I have been saying that for 20 years, but anyway.
Look, we're a long way from grave robbing. I think there's progress has been made.
I think we've made a lot of progress from there. So there's no doubt.
Pats on the back for us.
Not just technology, but ethical dilemmas have been resolved at least to some degree.
Yeah, 100%. Look, my response to this article was probably similar to yours. I think I enjoyed the process more than the conclusion, which was completely reasonable based on both the discussion and what you could kind of predict already. But it was a lovely way of synthesizing those really useful conversations that happen at conferences that often aren't harnessed. And there was a lot of careful detail within the methods section to describe just how much attention was paid to that, which I thought was really cool.
Yeah, I wish people did that more, because often when you see abstracts at a conference, they don't quite capture what goes on. And I think the idea about capturing what happens at the conference, not just what gets put into the conference, is I hope more people do that.
Absolutely. Well, shall we talk about speaking up for safety, Vic, our favourite topic?
Do we dare?
All right,
please,
bam,
go,
let's do
let's
it.
Let's go.
Okay. Well, look, I actually, and I love this article. So this is entitled, How Do Residents Respond to Uncertainty with Peers and Supervisors in Multidisciplinary Teams? Insights from Simulations with Epistemic Fidelity. It's by Sarah Blissett et al. And published in Advances in Simulation. And look, this was an article that I really enjoyed both for its research question and for its methodology. I think there's a lot to talk about with this one. At its heart, this paper explores the somewhat frustratingly timeless conundrum of how to get junior doctors to communicate effectively, but specifically about communicating uncertainty. And this to me is a really important thing, because it's an eternal struggle for myself. I'd find both in educational and clinical circles at how taboo it is to acknowledge in a medical setting that you don't know something or that you might not be 100% certain. And it kind of alarms me a lot at how uncomfortable this seems to be and how uncomfortable my juniors are at expressing uncertainty, despite the reality that there is 100% certainty in your career that we're going to be uncertain a lot of the time. It just doesn't make sense.
Absolutely.
And so, you know, while that's annoying in educational settings sometimes when you're trying to have a conversation and get people to share their thoughts, it can be downright life-threatening if it's in a clinical setting where people are either overcompensating and avoiding acknowledging they don't know what's going on or actively disguising that in some way. And so the article's introduction and background describe quite a wide array of existing literature that's already explored this, and particularly within junior doctors' approach to uncertainty. And what's clear from the paper is that there are a lot of recurrent themes. So junior doctors from both this paper and their background reading clearly weigh up an extraordinarily complex cocktail of social, political, cultural, epidemiological, and clinical factors when they're actually considering whether or not to acknowledge their uncertainty and who they're acknowledging that to. And importantly, I think even though they understand uncertainty as pervasive and unavoidable in medicine, they still have this huge volume of concerns. And I think, you know, it applies to many other settings as well, but certainly within the context of this paper. You're nodding?
Oh, totally. And anyway, I'm sure we'll get to the results, but I couldn't agree more with the danger of portraying certainty, particularly in interactions across specialties, when you don't have it, because you run the risk of people then matching your level of uncertainty, and now suddenly you've got two or more people who are quite sure about what they're doing who aren't quite sure about what they're doing.
Yeah, yeah, scary stuff. So moving on to the methods, this is another example of simulations use for research specifically, where the researchers provide a series of really quite carefully designed scenarios to act as both livable experiences for the participants and also kind of as a conversation starter for reflecting both on that experience and then their wider clinical practice as well. And we've seen that in a number of these papers recently from the senior author of this publication. And in this study, 14 junior doctors who were PGY 4, 5, and 6, so reasonably senior in their medical career in terms of their training pathways, who were working in cardiology or obstetrics and gynecology. And they participated in two sims involving pregnant patients with very rare complications of heart disease. So these were definitely zebras rather than horse hoofbeats. And the patients in these scenarios, you know, it would pretty much be an impossibility for anyone in sim or real clinical practice, I think, to clinically come to the correct diagnosis straight away, which I think was made it well designed because this was a scenario designed to force function people into acknowledging their uncertainty because there was really no other choice. So they ran the scenarios with peers and senior confederates, and then afterwards everyone involved was involved in debriefing the scenario, which was recorded and then analyzed. And look, the findings are both completely believable, not super surprising, but also maddening depending on your stance here. And there's a lot of really lovely qualitative reflections and quotes.
Oh, can we just talk about the methods for a minute?
Yes.
Yes, because I think this is really important. And the whole idea about this epistemic fidelity, the idea of the knowledge is what's realistic and the social milieu in which people are talking about their sense of certainty is realistic. So I think it's worth just double-clicking on that, as you have. I think it's also, I like this terminology, simulation-primed qualitative inquiry, which basically says using sim to explore phenomena, and in this case, social and cognitive and communication phenomenon. But I was kind of slightly disappointed by a couple of aspects of their design of their simulation. And just to give you an idea for people who are vaguely in this world, one is an antepartum endocarditis and one is an antepartum spontaneous coronary artery dissection. So as you said, these are definitely the zebras. But they used mannequins for both of these scenarios where most of the uncertainty was actually going to be conveyed in trying to recognize cues and historical data. And I don't know why they threw in the cardiac arrest in the second one, where I feel like you could have had all the uncertainty generated by working with a simulated patient actor, which given the extent that they went to for the epistemic fidelity, I would have also liked a little bit more task and patient fidelity. So is that too much, Ben? Too critical?
I think that's very fair. I think the only challenge that goes through my head when you say that is how to replicate at that level of depth that experience, I have no idea how to even approach in terms of what that patient's going to feel like, look like, their color. That to me would be the challenge. And I
have no doubt it's very challenging, but I would back a human being to do it better than a mannequin any day.
Yeah, 100%.
But I feel like they needed the mannequin because they put the cardiac arrest in at the end of the second one. And I don't know how important that was to have the cardiac arrest in there. It obviously created interactions between the two groups and some time pressure to what they did. But I feel like a lot of the uncertainty all happened before that. So anyway, hopefully Taryn Taylor and the first author will get in contact and explain to us
why they did what they did. Well, I guess it does force you to then acknowledge your uncertainty during a time of crisis. So, you know, you've gone from doing an interview to, okay, now the shit has hit the fan and we still don't know what's going on and we've got to make some decisions based on very limited information.
Yeah, they certainly got into some new areas of uncertainty.
Mm. Yeah, 100%.
Anyway, sorry to interrupt, but I thought it was because the methods here are so helpful in terms of contributing new and different ways of using simulation to help us understand things in healthcare. I thought it was worth just talking about that.
No offense taken, Professor Brazel, as always, a delightful direction to go down. Where was I? So
Findings,
thank you. There's some nice quotes in there. And what's interesting is that the residents are pretty comfortable communicating uncertainty with their peers. So they still do code it a fair bit, and particularly in front of the patient, but it certainly doesn't stress them out. And they argue that they really appreciate it when seniors express uncertainty, but they'd also really like it if seniors were really certain in a crisis, which felt a little unfair, to be honest, on the other side. And they respond with very strong confidence that there can be negative consequences for those who don't put forward a perfectly formed differential and management plan in their clinical lives. And that could lead to consequences like decreased opportunities, decreased time in surgery, all of the things that I think are probably fair, but sometimes also, at least some of the time, maybe more in the mind of the junior than the senior. And I wonder how much of that is an internal perception, although I'm sure some of it is very real for some people. They also describe some really subtle epidemiological things that change their risk tolerance. So if it's a younger person, they're more likely to admit their uncertainty to a senior. And I was interested in that because I thought, is that because there's a perceived bigger clinical risk, or because younger people have higher social value in our society and therefore seems somehow appropriate to finally acknowledge your uncertainty because the stakes are higher? It's ethically troubling. Or I wasn't sure whether it just was related to peds and people feeling comfortable that that's so different that you could just acknowledge it. So what to do with all this information, I think, is the challenge. And it's a big question. I think the author team importantly acknowledged that a start to improving things would be embedding cultural expectations, that disclosure of uncertainty is an expectation, not a consolation, and that it's a heavy risk to not do so and to find moments in training that highlight the inevitability of uncertainty in healthcare. And I think that's a really important thing.
Absolutely. And they've written a lovely discussion, really clear, thoughtful, and a couple of little concepts in there about adaptive expertise, and I think that is an important body of work and thread of academic conversation that's relevant to this. I also like, they said this actually in the introduction, about how things are shifting a little bit, and now expressing uncertainty in clinical environments can shift from becoming hushed to heard. And I like that. You know, people are more inclined to recognize that navigating uncertainty is one of the things that we do. It was so disappointing, wasn't it, that when they were just engaged in problem solving, they knew that sharing uncertainty was sensible, but they didn't see supervisors as helping them to navigate uncertainty. Their supervisor's role as evaluator trumped the supervisor's role as actually helping them do the hardest thing they do, which is navigate uncertainty. And my sort of ER, emergency department reflexivity was coming through, because I feel like we do a lot of that, possibly because we're co-located with our trainees a lot of the time. So maybe that is easier to do. Maybe we just have uncertainty higher on our radar because more of our work is in uncertainty. I'm not sure. But it's interesting, and it doesn't bode well for the sort of coaching and feedback role of seniors in doing that. As to what, you know, then the bigger question, what do we do with this? Because it's one thing to have the simulation primed qualitative inquiry, but then when we discover phenomenon, particularly if we discover things that we're pretty sure are there in the clinical environment, but we haven't been able to go deep enough, how do we encourage more sharing of uncertainty? I suspect the people who participated in this study are now probably sharing more uncertainty because they've actually had the issue heightened for them. But what does either an educational program, a structural intervention, culture shaping, what does that look like in order to encourage that? I'm not quite sure. I kind of feel like you'd have to have some very, very clear behavioral reward. And at the moment, it's not there because they see people around them all the time being rewarded and admired for certainty.
Yeah, that's a pretty tricky Pavlovian sequence to set up and socialize. But I agree. I think I remember getting actually 360 feedback from Anonymous Register written up one time, and one of the positive comments was, "We appreciate that he just says he doesn't know something." And that was a real shock to me that they saw that not as a positive, but like that wasn't standard. And so I think, yeah, it's a very interesting challenge to try and face. And I think that whole culture of medical perfectionism is a very challenging one to undo, particularly as I think there are some societal tropes that clearly get embedded somewhere along the hidden curriculum that become very densely baked in, even if the senior physicians who are working with you aren't at all role modeling those same behaviors.
I think so. And then there's also a bit of a double message. I think I can see a difference between expressing uncertainty and having a clear plan that gives strong guidance in an emergency situation. I think I can see the liminal space between those two things, but I think a lot of others would conflate the two.
Yeah, 100%. That went through my mind as I was reading too. It's one thing to say we have undifferentiated shock and are unclear of the cause, but we're going to proceed with X. As opposed to, I have no idea what's going on or why they're sick.
All right, Ben. Well, we watch this space. I have a feeling that this group has got lots more coming, so we'll look forward to that.
Yeah, no, big shout out to Taryn Taylor and the crew. I really enjoy their exploration of this because I think it has been exasperatingly superficial for so long. It's been nice to see the depth that they're taking in qualitative research in this area.
All right. Well, to finish up, our last relatively short paper is titled Writing a Research Abstract for a Conference, 12 Tips to Excel in Your Work. And this is by Carla Sakuto et al., writing in the International Journal of Healthcare Simulation just this last month or so. And it's in a section of the journal called Key Concepts. And essentially the whole paper is a big infographic. So obviously this is a relatively innovative format, and at the top of the infographic is the introduction, and I might as well just read it because it's just two sentences. High-quality conference abstract writing is a crucial skill to effectively communicate research, maximize the likelihood of acceptance, and ensure attendees understand the significance of the work. The following 12 tips support the creation of a compelling abstract that meets international conference quality standards and captures the attention of your peers. So it was very compelling, and I thought that was better than six long paragraphs of introduction. Two sentences seemed to capture the whole thing. And I thought there, for what it's worth, their 12 tips were pretty good. And the first three of them were just really pay attention to the details. Make sure you're submitting to the right conference. You're submitting the right abstract type, that you're not putting in a research abstract when actually what you've got is a essay type conversation, and stick to the guidelines. If it wants you to do it in a certain structure, do it in a certain structure. And they actually take a little pause there and say, look, if you've done these things, you've probably avoided a lot of the mistakes that we see. They talk about having an attractive but meaningful title. I personally do agree that there's nothing worse than having some title that just is "The Rolling Stone Gathers No Moss," and then you have no idea what it's about. Like, I do think you need to say, yeah, there's some actual meaning in the title. Contextualize the work, which is another way of just saying, have you I read around and do you know how this fits in with everything else? And just take a little aside here, Ben, but I was lucky enough when I was down in Melbourne, I got to hear Kevin Ever talk, and he's the editor-in-chief of Medical Education. And he said, if someone actually writes in their abstract, we're the first to look at blah, he said that's a massive red flag.
Makes total sense.
So don't go saying in your research abstract that we're the only people ever to have done this, unless you truly are.
That would actually make a really nice, then, simple infographic, can I say, as well, for publication.
And then the others all make intuitive sense. A concise but complete description of the methods, show your results and key finding, provide a meaningful discussion, have references and keywords, be clear and concise, use appropriate authorship, and review. Give it to someone to read who isn't kind of in your author group or doesn't really know your context, and does it still make sense to them? So I thought these were pretty nice, but I found myself comparing it to Lorelei Lingard's and Chris Watling's book, Story Not Study. They've got a chapter on how to write an abstract, which had a lot of the similar kind of principles, particularly about just paying attention to the mechanics type detail, but then also not getting lost in being too repetitive, but also sometimes using the abstract to help gather your thoughts together about the work that you've done. And that's particularly relevant for a conference where you've not got a manuscript to begin with. So I really enjoyed this. I think that's a good thing to put in the journal. I think what I would have actually liked was a bit more about the authors. I know the authors, and I know that they are editors of journals in simulation. I know that they're on scientific committees of CSAM and other conferences. And so I know that they've got the goods, but I feel like probably it's important if you're writing an article like this to put your credibility out there. So as I said, these authors have got it, but I don't know that you would know that if you just picked up the paper. So I'd be wanting to know where they came from.
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting ask there, because I think we don't have a clear process for infographic publication in terms of how to do that. And, you know, many of the features of an infographic are inherently synthesizing and minimizing the volume of information. So when I was reading it, one thing that struck me was the reference section. So what does the reference section actually mean in this process? You know, does it imply that you've just read those and they've informed your design, because or are you specifically quoting and referencing particular text within it, stuff like that? So, no, it was very, very interesting. I was really excited to see. And I think IJOS in general is publishing some less stereotypically academic formats that I think have huge value. And I can imagine passing this on to one of my sim fellows, for example, who wants to present at a conference, as being a really, really helpful, synthesized, attractive thing to pick up and just help them through that process. So I thought it was great.
Yeah, it reminds me a little bit of the academic medicine last page infographics, which I really enjoy. And I just take my hat off to people who are able to condense often quite complex things down to a relatively straightforward and succinct structure that, sure, you might go beyond at some point. But if you're interested in this kind of format, go and have a look at a couple of academic medicine last page sections. One thing I would say is that they didn't mention, because it was an infographic, but that Lorelei Lingard has just mentioned in her most recent article, which is getting ChatGPT to write your abstract if you feed in your manuscript or writing notes or various other things. And it was one of the things she found ChatGPT was quite good at. Maybe not necessarily as good coming up with the overall, but if you find yourself with 345 words and you need to have 300 words, ChatGPT, once you work out what 300 is, actually is pretty good at that.
Well, funny you should mention AI, because I opened up the PDFs in preparation for this, and you know how I feel about AI, but a little window popped up and it said, now I was relatively short of time this week, would you like us to synthesize the contents of this article for you? And I was A, disgusted, and then B, print, oh, I'll have a look, I'll see what it comes up with. And it was pretty good, but it was also very distressing for me to A, again, as with many people, watching one of your core roles be automated by AI, but secondly, also that worry about we can process things and it'll be really easy and convenient, but what is the consequence on us actually reading all of the richness of this? But it was an interesting, I don't think it's a Sophie's choice, is it? But it was certainly a temptation.
Look, Ben, I think you can use all the AI you like and it will not replace the odd Ben Simon rant that we're all here for. I have a feeling there's going to be some human input still required, maybe next time, and we can just get ChatGPT to simulate our voices. ChatGPT, generate a simulcast episode in the style of Victoria Brazel and Ben Simon.
It would be an interesting academic exercise.
Using these four articles.
Mm. Let's give it a whirl.
Yeah. All right. Be careful with your wish for simulcast listeners. All right. Well, looking forward to seeing you again next month, Ben. And in between times, we've got our Writers' Festival with Lorelei Lingard. Looking forward to seeing you there. And no doubt everyone's also getting excited about going to CSAM and many other simulation things. But for now, this is Vic and Ben signing off for Simulcast.
Thank you for listening to Simulcast.